here, so. But it's great to be back, and I'll be gone next week in Florida with Kathy. We're going to be doing an extensive speaking tour of Florida. But after that, I think I'm going to be back until February, so we'll have a good time getting back into the Word. And let me just give you a little report of what's been happening these past few weeks. We were in Hawaii doing a creation conference there. It was a very interesting conference, and it was headed up by a former staff member here at SMC, Rick Bunshu. He was the youth pastor here 25 to 28 years ago, and he's now pastoring the largest and fastest growing church in the Hawaiian Islands, kind of a surface church. But he gave me his latest book. It's just been released, and it's called Don't Rock the Boat, Capsize It. Okay? It says, loving the church too much to leave it the way it is. But it's loaded with funny stories of his life here at SMCC. He never mentions the church by name, but the one that I enjoyed the most is where he talked about how they were doing this major thing for Easter Sunday morning. And it was going to be a breakfast before the five services goes, which means they're all here at 4 a.m. Getting ready to make a pancake breakfast for everybody. And he and a fellow who was a prominent in this church, Bob McDonald back then, arrived at 4 a.m. and discovered that all the cupboards that had all the kitchen utensils in it, the frying pans, etc., was locked. And then he tells this story about what he calls the kitchen goddesses, or how there's a women's group in the church. Maybe they still exist, I don't know. But back that time, there was this women's group that had, quote, the cupboards that was for the junk that people could use and youth people could use, but then there was keys for the good stuff. But they really needed the good stuff to be able to serve breakfast for several hundred people. They needed a big frying pan, etc., and there was no key. There was a key that was promised to them, but the key never arrived. And so they debated 4 o'clock in the morning, do we wake up these goddesses? And the guy says, no problem. He went in the car and got a crowbar. And so he was able to rip out the locks and all. Had a very successful Easter morning breakfast. It was an outstanding success. But he says he and Bob McDonald were banned from the kitchen from that point onward. And he uses that as kind of a segue into what they've done in their church, because they said when they built their church, the same thing happened. Oh, well, we have to have these cupboards, and we've got to lock this up, and we have to have committees. And Rick, based on his experience here at this church, said, no committees, and we will have locks, but he said, we will give a key to every member of the church. So every church family got a key, and there was only one key that opened everything. And the whole point is church members were encouraged to use the facilities of the church. And it says, yeah, we're going to run the risk every once in a while of a junior hire ripping off stuff or breaking stuff. But they said that's a lot less money than people not being able to get the stuff they need when they need it. So that gives you kind of a flavor of what's in the book. It's filled with funny stories, but each one ends with a lesson that he believes churches can follow to be more dynamic and more creative. By the way, when we were in his church, one of the things I really appreciated the most is they have this kind of a sanctuary facility, but there are no pews. There's kind of chairs like this, except in the front two rows. In the front two rows, they have these really nice leather couches. And they said, we've always had a problem getting people to sit in the front row. So they had these nice leather couches there, and indeed, you see people fighting to get in those front rows. Works out well. And the other thing is they set up their church in such a way that you can bring food and drink into any meeting. Of course, it's Hawaii, so they said, you know, if anything falls on the carpet or whatever, there's always lots of these giant insects that come in and take care of it. Not a problem. So everything is kept nice and clean, thanks to the fauna that exists there on the islands. But the other thing I thought was really great is they wanted a church where people would actually talk to one another and discuss things that were going on that morning of a spiritual nature. And so when you walk out of the church, there's an espresso machine, there's a latte machine, there's a smoothie machine, and there's all kinds of food and stuff. And so as a result, people come out of the worship service at noon and they're still there at 3 p.m. That's exactly what we wanted to happen. So then once again, don't rock the boat, capsize it. And Rick is probably one of the most creative pastors I've ever met, and it's just fun to see him now that he's in his middle age. He's still as creative as ever, and he's still catching those big waves. He's still really enjoying the surfing. So still very active, yeah. So yeah. He didn't join us on our death march, though. We kind of went into the high altitude swamp there, and Fuzz Rana refers to that as a Hughes death march, but it really wasn't that bad. So we all survived, and it's the only high altitude swamp in the world, and we got to see what was called a Nene bird. It's kind of like a size of a large chicken, but it doesn't fly, and we got to see three of them. So that was fun. Got pictures of them and all that. That was great. So I was really hoping to show Fuzz these giant centipedes that live on the island, and we never got to see the giant centipedes. They're almost a foot long and about that wide. So, and we didn't get to see any of the giant spiders either. So that was a real disappointment for the guys. I mean, the ladies were quite thrilled that we didn't get to see any of the giant spiders. So, but I've never seen spiders that spin 30-foot diameter webs before, except on that island. But we missed out. It was really too bad. So, one of the things that did happen while I've been gone from you is I had to make a quick trip to Houston. And the fifth reason was that Rick Smalley, the fellow that came to the Lord through reading our books, had died. And he and his family had asked if I would participate in the funeral, so I wound up flying out there to help out with the funeral. And, you know, Rick Smalley won the 1996 Nobel Prize in Chemistry. And about 16 months ago, I went out to Rice University to have a meeting with him, and also gave a lecture there at Rice that he attended. And the first of our books he read was The Creator and the Cosmos, and I got his email from him here. He says, I recently read the third edition of The Creator and the Cosmos. He has only a one-word description for it, which was, wow. And he was not yet a believer. And then he read the Origins of Life book next. And with respect to the Origins of Life book, he said, I must say, evolution has been dealt its death blow. And he says, my background in chemistry and physics has now made it clear that evolution could not have occurred. And then the third book he read was A Matter of Days. And he told his friend, Jim Tour, who was a colleague and a Christian, he says that he had read what he considered to be the most profound Christian book he'd ever seen. And then 2 days before he died, his wife finished reading to him Who is Adam? And he said that he was overwhelmed by the book, and if scientists read it, it could convert 50% of the science establishment. And he's even talking about reasons to believe in the last hour of his death. So, and I probably got paid the highest compliment ever from a scientist by Rick. This is a recent email I got from him. It says, I need to thank you for your life's work. You have, in fact, given me reasons to believe. I can now love God with all my mind. I'm amazed, I'm very impressed, and very grateful. And he says, please do continue your work. So this is an email I will keep for the rest of my life. And I was going to read to you the remarks. But by the way, the funeral was held at Second Baptist and Second Baptist of Houston. It's one of those small churches of only 30,000 members. So it's a six-story structure. And the nickname is they refer, it's got a huge dome over the middle of it, and so they call it the Bapta Dome. The other name for it is Six Flags Over a Baptist Church. Because they have three movie theaters and, six movie theaters and three full-sized basketball courts on their facility. So it really is one of those mega churches. But after he read A Matter of Days, he gave his life to Christ and made a public commitment of his life to Christ at Second Baptist and was baptized there at Second Baptist. And so for the funeral, they had his friend Jim Tour do the opening prayer. He's a chemistry professor and one of his colleagues in the nanotechnology group there. and then I spoke second, and then Ben Young, the pastor that baptized him and married him. He married a gal that he was dating just a few months before he died. There were about 400 that attended the funeral, including almost all of the science faculty from Rice University, and virtually all of the deans, and many from the president's office. The president himself is out of town, but the rest of his team was there. And the media was there, and there was also three from the development office at Hope College. Rick spent 2 years at a Christian college, his freshman and sophomore year. But I think that's where things kind of got sour for him, for the Christian faith. He's seen since that time the Christian faith as anti-scientific and anti-intellectual. In fact, I understand that when he would speak on nanotechnology in front of scientific audiences, he would always make remarks about just how ridiculous the Christian faith was. And one of the gals that spoke here in front of you, the theoretical physicist Erica Carlson, she heard him speak just 2 years ago, and she said that he spent one half of his message on nanotechnology just ripping into Christians and the Christian faith. And it kind of gives you kind of a sense for what you see in Revelation 3. I wish you were hot or cold. God can work with the ones that are cold. He can work with the ones that are hot. It's the ones that are apathetic and lukewarm that he struggles with. And Rick was never apathetic concerning the Christian faith. So Rick's senior grad students were there. Almost all of his family was there as well. And many from the humanities department, which I thought was quite interesting. I'm just going to read to you these remarks, and they are posted on Rice University's website. They'll be posted on ours, and if you want a copy of this, we can get you a copy. I was allowed 15 minutes, but I decided to keep my remarks briefer than that, and because I knew Ben was going to be following me and giving me the actual message. And so we had Jim Tour come forward, and he spent about 2 or 3 minutes giving a prayer, and I made a few personal remarks about Rick's life and what Rick meant to him. And Jim had a major part in his conversion as well. Jim had lived the Christian life in front of Rick. And Jim Tour's story is interesting too. He was raised an Orthodox Jew and gave his life to Christ. And he married into an Indian family, a bunch of Indian missionaries. So, but this is what I said after he had finished his prayer. I said, I am here because Pastor Ben Young called me 16 months ago to ask if I'd be willing to fly to Houston to answer a Nobel laureate's questions about science and the Christian faith. I knew ahead of time that Rick was a stickler for scientific credibility and integrity. I had expected him to besiege me with questions about biological evolution or about Bible passages he presumed conflicted with science. What I learned was that Rick loved to research frontiers of knowledge that few before him ever probed. The thrill of Rick's life was to explore and to invent. Others had asked me about God's purpose in creating the universe. Rick already had perceived that if God exists, he must have more than one purpose in creating. So we talked about the 7 different purposes in creating the universe that the Bible speaks of. And in light of these 7 purposes, Rick wanted to know exactly what we humans are supposed to do. He wanted to know why God would grant us free will. It was interesting. Free will and predestination was something we actually spent quite a bit of time talking about. He'd already concluded that no resolution of human free will and divine predetermination was possible within the dimensions of length, width, height, and time. And he asked if the extra dimensions implied by string theory and general relativity provided possible resolution, just before he had read Beyond the Cosmos. We discussed God's plan for ridding his creation of evil and how we humans presently benefit from our exposure to evil. He asked about the purposes of mass extinction events in a fossil record. That was probably the one biological issue we did talk about. The purpose of death, the reason for our short lifespans, and what life will be like in the new creation. Now, you need to understand that we were having this conversation at a time when he thought that he was in remission from his cancer, and if it was coming back, they felt they had a really good way of dealing with it. And, you know, they were going to do some bone marrow transplants, and he was supposed to have a complete recovery. The problem with Rick is that he wound up getting a fungal infection in his lungs, and that fungal infection prevented them from giving him the therapy that would have saved his life. So that's how he died, but he could have easily lived another 30 years. Most scientists I know allow peer pressure and their specialized research endeavors to divert them from exploring the most important issues of the cosmos and life. And just to make a comment here, most scientists I know who are at the level of Rick Smalley are just having way too much fun. So much fun that they never really consider the important issues of life. I'd often refer to that level of scientific research as the equivalent of playing video games. And you play these video games and it's so distracting and so captivating, you really don't think about the really significant issues of life or what you need to do. So most scientists I know allow peer pressure or specialized research endeavors to divert them from exploring the most important issues of the cosmos and life. I've found this to be especially so for Nobel laureates. But Rick was different. He had the humility and the courage to pursue the big truth questions regardless of personal cost to his reputation. Later, Rick and his fiancée, Debbie, attended my evening lecture at Rice University on dark energy and the destiny of humanity. They sat in the second row with Rick furiously taking notes. I remember that he asked by far the most insightful question of the evening. You know, I put that in there hoping that all these professors would ask me what that question was afterwards, and it worked well. So a couple of weeks later, I got an email from Rick where he described how he used those notes to craft what I knew to be a much superior talk that he gave before 1,000 students at Tuskegee. Those students gave Rick a rousing standing ovation, and Rick made an important discovery that day. I said to the audience, "Let me give you some background. As many of you know," I told the audience, "Rick is not only famous for discovering the buckyball and for developing nanotechnology, he's even better known in political and educational circles for alerting our leaders to America's science education crisis. Rick and I were both children during the Sputnik era. At that time, America spared no expense in raising up an army of scientists and engineers. I recall that my high school physics teacher was paid twice as much as the other teachers." You know, they don't let that happen anymore, I understand. Pardon me? The unions don't like that. But see, at that time, they did not consider that to be a problem. And so, and then the other thing I said is, thanks to a Texas millionaire, and I was in Texas, this is Houston, says, thanks to a Texas millionaire, I and a few other high school students in Vancouver got to spend every Thursday hearing seminars and many Saturdays doing experiments with the leading science faculty at the University of British Columbia. What I most remember about that era, though, is that scientists and others saw science as a potent tool, a tool that not only could probe the secrets of the cosmos, but also solve many of the outstanding problems in sociology, philosophy, and theology. This aggressive application of scientific research captivated the general public and attracted swarms of promising youth to pursue science careers. Today, we have sanitized science. We've made it impotent by pretending science has no capacity to put to the test important questions of sociology, philosophy, and religion. Consequently, we are making science boring, and this to a large degree explains our science education crisis. And just to give you some background, the audience all knew this, but Rick was the one that made a major presentation at the Presidential Council back a few years ago, where he made the point that 20 years ago, 30 years ago, America was graduating more scientists and engineers than the rest of the world combined. Today, we barely are able to compete with South Korea. South Korea graduates more engineers than the entire United States. And all universities in the country are seeing science and engineering enrollment by Native Americans dropping. Basically, they're filling the classroom with foreign students. And if you take the average over the whole country, one-third of the scientists and engineers the United States graduates are from overseas. Only two-thirds are from North America, and that is declining rapidly. So, but Rick was the one that's responsible for alerting the president and his council that, hey, we got a major crisis here. Okay, today we have sanitized science. We made it impotent by pretending science has no capacity to put to the test important questions of sociology, philosophy, and religion, consequently making science boring, and this to a large degree explains our science education crisis. I know from my conversations with Rick that the last year of his life was his most thrilling as a scientist. In his words, he learned that, quote, he need not throw his mind away when reading the Bible, end quote. The Bible made him an even better scientist and a more inspiring science educator. 3 months ago, my wife wrote to a theoretical physicist and a chemist on her mailing list who had heard Rick lecture to ask them to pray. She wrote, quote, we want Rick to live, but more importantly, we want what God wants, end quote. Rick was only 62. With another 30 years, he could have done great things for his newfound Savior. But like the young prophet Stephen in the book of Acts, could it be that Rick's untimely death will bring about an unimaginable spiritual breakthrough? Consider that the death of Stephen led to the conversion of Paul and Paul's authoring of 13 books of the Bible. And I just kind of looked out at the audience and says, I believe in this auditorium are dozens of men and women with the courage and the humility to take up the baton that Rick at the end of his life has passed on. A baton of being willing to seriously ask the big questions of life, of having the humility to submit to the truth about God, revealed both through the record of nature and the words of the Bible, and of having the courage to make science exciting again by publicly standing up for the multitude of new scientific reasons to believe that there is a God who has created, a God who knows our fallen condition and desires to rescue us if only we would ask. And the audience was predominantly non-Christians. Now, you guys must have been praying for me, because I got on that plane having no idea what I was going to say. I wrote these 2 pages of notes while I was on the plane. And when I got off the plane, Ben Young called me and said, Hugh, I got a real problem with this message. I really don't know what to say at this message, and we got to speak tomorrow at this funeral. And so he said, can you give me some idea what you're going to say? And I says, yeah, I got it all written out already. So I read it to him, and he says, okay. Now, he was up till 3 o'clock in the morning trying to put together. What he had to say was really quite good. But, hey, I want to thank you for praying, because it would have been tough if I didn't have that opportunity on the plane. And, by the way, there's a guy right beside me watching what I was writing. And we got into a really interesting conversation, and because I finished it about a half hour before the plane ride was going to end, and so he asked for the business card and wanted to get on our. And he wasn't a believer, but he sure wanted to check things out. Want to know all about this Rick Smalley guy? So I got to tell him about that. So that was fun. But what was really interesting was that. The church had a reception just a few feet away from where we had the funeral ceremony itself. And everybody came. All 400 people showed up for the reception. And I got to talk to a lot of professors that day. And in particular, there were 6 professors, 2 from the physics department, 1 biologist, and 3 from the chemistry department. That talked to me and said, you know, we really agree with your remarks about the science education crisis. Which one of your books do you recommend we start with? And these guys were all atheists. They told me they were atheists. They were skeptics. They said, you know, that's what we admired about Rick Smalley, was that he was skeptical of all this religious nonsense going on. It sounds like that Rick has found something that's not religious nonsense. So, they all made a commitment they would start reading our books, and I got my card to go on the website. What I thought was a real miracle is I got to talk to 2 professors from the humanities department. Now, if you know anything about universities, I usually say, well, if you're talking to mathematicians, 70% of them already believe in God and an afterlife. If you're talking to physicists, it's like 50%. Biologists, it's like 30%. But if you're in the humanities department, it's like 1%. Or worse. So, but these 2 guys from the humanities department, they were in their early 60s, about the same age as Rick, and both of them also said, look, this has made a profound impact on us. We've been ignoring the Christian faith all of our life. We want to start. Again, which of your books should we start with? So, and then I got to talk to Rick's family. His sister has always, she's been a Christian for 30 years. And she'd been praying for Rick all 30 of those years. Says, yeah, I never gave up on my brother. Just kept praying for him. But as I was talking to her, she said, you know, I'm concerned about my brother. Because Rick had an older brother. Says, would you go please talk to him? Well, before we finish, the older brother came over, and the way he was, he's a very quiet guy, unlike Rick and his sister, very soft spoken, very shy, but he just started talking to us, and it was a great relief to the sister to discover he was already a believer. He just had never told anybody about him, but now he was anxious to talk to people about it, and he says, you know, all, and in fact, that's kind of what he said, was that, I've been so quiet about my Christian faith. What today has told me is I need to be bold like my brother and start talking about it. So that was a real joy for the sister. And then afterwards, the sister says, would you go please talk to Rick's older boy? He had an 8-year-old son and a son who was probably in his 30s. And this would have been Chad. So I made a beeline over to Chad. And Chad's, I think it was his girlfriend. I don't think they were married. And Chad started talking first, and he said, your dad gave me the Creator and the Cosmos, and I read it, and then I bought about a dozen copies. He's been giving them out to his friends, and I went back to my dad and said, which book should I read next? And he said, you got to read A Matter of Days. So he said he'd read that, and meanwhile, his Rick's sister came over and said, I don't think you need to worry about Chad. I mean, he's giving the books away to everybody. He's so excited and enthusiastic. If he's not a believer, it's just going to be around the corner. His enthusiasm is really unbridled. And so this is a great day of rejoicing for the sister, because she had been wondering, is there anyone in the family who's saved? And just to discover that, that was really exciting. Rick's two stepdaughters also came forward and found out that they, too, had very recently given their lives to Christ and been much impacted by Rick's testimony. So you can tell I had a fun time there. I got to talk to Rick's grad students, and something else that happened literally in the last hour of Rick's life was that, you know, his lab, I mean, he got the Nobel Prize for being the one that discovered the structure of the buckyball. That's a gigantic carbon atom with 60 carbons, atoms, and it kind of makes a soccer ball thing. And astronomers have known for some time that there were exotic molecules coming to Earth that they couldn't figure out how they got to Earth without being destroyed while they're encased in these buckyballs. But what really has fueled Rick's life these last few years is to go from buckyballs to bucky tubes, where they make these long nanotubes of carbon. And his lab has made them several inches long, and what they're really trying to do is find a process to make them miles long so they can use them to transmit electricity at very low cost, with very little loss. But the problem had been that no lab had ever been able to replicate his lab's results, and therefore was considered not to be a proven technology. But literally the hour before they died, another lab had replicated the results, and his two graduate students came in to tell him. And Rick did understand what had happened. So, and I got to talk to those two grad students. And they, too, are recent believers. So this is, you know, and to give you the context for all of this, you all know that places like Yale and Harvard were founded as Christian universities to train people in the Christian faith and applying to Christianity. Rice University is the opposite. It was founded by a secular humanist to promote secular humanism. And yet I find it a great irony, that's a campus that has a lot of evangelical faculty. So maybe we need more campuses like that. I don't know. So, but, yeah, and I got to meet some of the, because I've spoken at Rice twice before, and it was fun just to meet some of the Christians that had been there. Yes. No, when faculty would come to me and ask me which book they should start reading first, I asked them some questions about their exposure to the Christian faith. If they had absolutely no exposure at all and there was no bitterness towards the Christian faith, I recommended that they start with The Creator and the Cosmos. But there were a few of them there who said that they had been exposed to the Christian community, and they had a lot of problems with the Bible's science, you know, supposed scientific accuracy. So in that case, I said, well, why don't you start with a Genesis question? Or if I knew that they had been exposed a lot to young earth creationism, and, you know, Rice University, there's a lot of students there who try to convert their science faculty with the young earth material. So in that case, it said a matter of days. I mean, but the interesting thing is there's usually quite a few of them hanging around me while I was talking about all this, and a lot of them said, well, we need to do it, Rick did. We need to get all three. So they would do that. Rick's question that he asked, this is before he'd read the Beyond the Cosmos, but he was listening to my lecture on dark energy, and we got into a little discussion about string theory. Because we had talked about that earlier that day in his office. So he said, well, you know, I just want to pick up on a conversation we had in my office and ask if there's a resolution to how God can answer all of our prayers simultaneously in the context of his possibly working in extra or trans dimensions. And so that led to a discussion that the entire audience really appreciated. Evidently there were lots of students there who had the same question. So, and that's the thing I appreciated about Rick. He didn't ask trivial questions or make trivial points. He got at the really big issues. And apparently that's been the way he's done his research all of his life. He has this grasp of being able to get to the most significant research problems and the focus on that. So let me give you a quick report also on what happened in Vancouver and Seattle and a city I'd never been to before, Burlington. I arrived in Vancouver. This would have been last Saturday night, and a Sunday morning I was speaking in 10th Avenue Alliance Church. And Kathy, my wife back there, we visited that church probably, 25 years ago? And we visited that church. It's about 2 miles, a little less than 2 miles from my dad's house in Vancouver. Kind of in the middle of Vancouver, and it was maybe 100 people there maximum, and most of the people that were there were well beyond their 60s, and it seemed like there was a coterie of people that were really trying to control the church. They did preach the gospel, but when I went back this time, they had a new pastor, a Japanese Canadian. And he has education in engineering and science. And he's really taken the church to a whole new level. Now they have two services. The church is bigger than what it was when we were there 25 years ago. And they drew 300 people, which was packed out to the gills in both services. A lot of people brought guests. And it was just really fun being in that church. And they were all set up for my PowerPoint presentation, because apparently they do PowerPoints all the time. I mean, it's kind of one of my pet peeves in working with churches, how they only use PowerPoint for music. And so the cable is sitting there about 80 feet in the back. And what they always tell me to do is, oh, just give me a disc or a CD and we'll do it from the back. But that means you got to give your message blind. You can't see what the audience is seeing. And also all the little neat features in PowerPoint or not, but this church had it all figured out. Everything was really working very well. And I was really impressed at how the Christians in that church had brought so many guests. And again, I got to meet a lot of professors from the University of British Columbia who had never been to church before in their lives, and it was just fun talking to them. Again, they had me give that message I gave at Rice University on dark energy and the destiny of humanity. And that evening, I got to speak for the first time at Regent College. That's one of the seminaries on the University of British Columbia campus. It's the only, there's 10 seminaries on that campus, but only one would be evangelical. The other nine are quite liberal in their theology. And the Regent has really gained some prominence in the Christian community. That's where J.I. Packer is, and they have a number of other prominent people there. John Stackhouse and others. And John was there, and they have this kind of, it's like theater in a round. I mean, you're kind of sitting in the bottom of this pit, and then there's people all the way around you. But it made it for a rather intimate setting, as about 300 people jammed in, standing room only. And I spoke for a little less than an hour, but the Q&A went on for 3 more hours. with almost nobody leaving. And our chapter people sold out of all their books. The Regent College bookstores sold out of all their books. The professors there were very excited. And I think what's really going to be a thrill for our Vancouver chapter, Regent College just says, look, you guys want to do more events here, this would be terrific. They were really excited. And the Regent College really has never done events for the community before. So this is a breakthrough. And our chapter have been trying to get something going on a campus for some time. So that was really fun. And also our chapter people picked up 300 names of people who want to get involved in the chapter. You can pray for them because this is a chapter of 50 members, and now they have all these people that are interested. So, but include some outstanding leaders there at Regent College. The next day I flew to Seattle, and my first meeting was with the campus ministry leaders at the University of Washington. And there's probably a dozen different Christian clubs on that campus, largest of which is Campus Crusade International Students Incorporated. And we just got to spend a couple of hours strategizing how to reach the University of Washington for Christ. None of these campus leaders had ever heard of Reasons to Believe. And they'd literally been praying that they could get some kind of science faith stuff started on the campus, had no idea where to go. They were even thinking of bringing in the young earth creationists, but quite a few of them there said, no, we don't want to do that. Because apparently one ministry brought Dwayne Gish in a few years ago, and that was a real problem. I mean, you need to understand this: the state of Washington has the lowest church attendance of any state in the union. And that particular campus is really dominated by people who are very aggressive against the Christian faith. But it was a bit of a shock to me that absolutely none of them ever heard of Reasons to Believe, had no idea we existed. And for that reason, they're unwilling to sponsor us. We were sponsored by the Seattle chapter. So, but after it was all over, the leader says, boy, we got to get behind this for the future. And again, what I told the Seattle chapter, look, you've got excellent people with PhDs in your chapter. You don't need fuzz in me. You can take advantage of this opportunity now that we've got the attention of those leaders. And I got to spend the next day meeting with Jeanette Bernard. She's an old member of this church. Not old, she's quite a bit younger than I am. But she lost her husband, Scott, who was quite involved in this church. In fact, his brother was the college pastor in this church. And her husband died the same day that Rick Smalley died. So I got to spend some time with her. And you know how it is when you spend time with people like that, they tend to minister more to you than you do to them. And it was really good. Then we went on to a salmon barbecue up in Burlington. The people in the state of Washington know how to do things. I mean, this was really a great thing. But they had all these ministry leaders there. And this church in Burlington, it was really fun just to meet with the people who started this church before I spoke there. It was started by a guy in his late 40s and his son. And these were guys that ran a wrecking yard. And they were in this little town just south of Bellingham, and they were looking for a church to attend. And they searched all over for a church that they would feel comfortable in, but they said the churches in our area were all liberal in their theology. And then there were a bunch of cults. And they said, we just can't do this. And driving to Bellingham was just too far. So they decided just to do a Bible study on Sunday morning. Well, that Bible study grew. And when it got to be 250 people, they said, you know, this isn't really a Bible study anymore. Maybe we need to think about turning this into a church. But these guys are a lot like Rick Bunshu, very creative. And they said, we're not going to do church the way other people do church. And and the son was very much a skeptic, and he discovered our materials, and then he told me over the barbecue, he says, you know, at least half of my sermons are straight from your books. So I hope you don't mind. I'm just plagiarizing your stuff all over the place. So, but the book that really impacted him was Beyond the Cosmos, and he says, I've just been using that so much in my teaching. And using it as a way to reach out to the skeptics in the community. And then he told me about the literally hundreds of people that have come to Christ. He says, we do not pick up members from other churches. We're picking up adult converts, people who come to Christ through the ministry. And these guys are real evangelists. They both love to do evangelism. But the dad has now turned the ministry over to the son. And the son's a really sharp guy. And, you know, when the pastors get behind something like this, things really work. We had 700 people show up that evening. So that's not bad for, I think it was like a Monday night event. So, and again, they brought all kinds of non-Christian people. And it was just fun talking to these non-Christians afterwards. They asked me to survey the best scientific evidence for the God of the Bible. So I kind of went into four different disciplines, gave them a quick survey, and we had 3 hours of Q&A afterwards. And again, the pastors looked around. Nobody was leaving. They all just stayed for that. So, and the chapter people were just overwhelmed. They only had four people up there because it was a long drive from Seattle. But fortunately, we were able to get some people in the church to help out as well. So that's kind of what was been going on. And then Kathy and I will be going to Florida to do some speaking there. I think we leave Tuesday, right? And we'll get back, the next Monday. So we will miss next Sunday. And I came here with a really terrific scientific discovery to report to you about, but maybe we ought to get into the book of Job. What do you think? Want to do Job? All right. Can we do both? Well, maybe we can. It's a brand new discovery about where we got the fluorine. And this is one of the amazing things about the solar system, is that it's so fluorine rich compared to all the other planetary systems that exist in our galaxy. And this is a paper where they figured out where we got the fluorine, and it's giving us a whole new veneer of evidence for the supernatural design of Earth for the benefit of life. You may not think, you think that fluorine's only good for your teeth? No. Fluorine's got a lot of uses. But it's something that scientists have noted for some time, is that you really do need fluorine for advanced life, and it's just utterly amazing that we have the fluorine that we need for advanced life. Well, let me spend a little bit of time in the book of Job. When we got some time left over, I'll talk about this fluorine discovery. Otherwise, we'll get to it week after next. But I want to finish up our discussion on bad designs in nature. And remember I told you when I was here last time that it seems like the community of non-theistic scholars have really latched on to bad designs as their big argument against the Christian faith. And the argument goes like this. If there really is this God of the Bible, this is a God that's all-powerful and all-loving and very smart and intelligent. He should know what he's doing. But the fact that we see all these bad designs in nature tells us that this is either an incompetent God, a stupid God, or there is no God at all. And so that's kind of the big push against the Christian faith. And, I heard about it when I was in Houston, but I was also discovering that it made its way up to Vancouver and Seattle, because both of those points came up during the Q&A time. So evidently, the atheistic community is pushing this a little bit harder than I thought they were. And that's kind of why I wanted to bring it up here in the class, and it just fits right in with Job 40. Where Job 40, we have the Lord speaking to Job and his four friends and really upbraiding them for accusing him of not knowing what he's doing. And that's basically what these people are doing. They're saying, well, gee, these designs look terrible. I guess you don't know what you're doing, or maybe you don't even exist. And really what the Lord says in the first 14 verses of Job 40 is, I'll just summarize it. How dare we call God's actions and motives into question when we lack so much knowledge and understanding? So here we are condemning God for what we really don't understand. And that's kind of the heart of what's going on in this argument about bad design. And as I told you a couple of weeks ago, this argument is even making it on popular television. How Jon Stewart on his Daily Show, which is on Comedy Central, and I wasn't aware how many people watch that network. My sons tell me that it's got a big audience, especially with teenage boys, I guess, but it's not just teenage boys. A lot of people are watching that. And if you haven't ever seen that show, it's kind of a spoof on news programs. After all, when you turn on TV, at least, one quarter of the news or one quarter of the shows on TV are talking about current events and the news. So this is kind of a spoof on that. But Jon Stewart had, it wasn't Michael B., it was Bill Dembski. He had Bill Dembski on his show, And then he immediately brought up this point of bad designs in nature. And the bad design he brought up was the fact that the human male has this paper-thin scrotal sac. And this is surely a bad design. And Bill Dembski really didn't have an appropriate response. And as I mentioned last time, one of the things that these non-theists love to do is bring up something that's, quote, embarrassing to talk about, all right? And, you know, Christians kind of have that reputation. We get easily embarrassed by such things, and so we often just kind of sit there. And it's quite possible that Bill did have a good answer, but, you know, when you bring up something of that nature, especially on a comedy show, you really don't know what's going to be going down here. So it didn't go well. But I found it quite interesting that the same question came up in Vancouver and Seattle. So evidently the word... Another one that's been coming up is the inverted retina, the human eye. Ever heard that one? That, you know, we have this terrible design in our eye system. And the terrible design that's being pointed out is how the light receptors in the human eye, instead of being in front of the light, are behind the light. In other words, the light comes into your eyeball. It goes through this structure that holds the eyeball together. But rather than the light receptors being on the front, they're on the back. So here you've got this support structure for the eye, and you'd expect, you know, the God knows what he's doing. He's going to put the light receptors where they're actually going to get the most light and get the most definition. Instead, they're behind it. Well, again, this is a classic example of scientists saying, well, this looks really bad to us, without asking the question, maybe there's a hidden reason why it's designed in a way that doesn't look so good to us. Maybe we need to research this more. And as I told you last time, if you get stuck on one of these, I mean, maybe you have no idea why the human scrotal sac is as thin as it is. And if you really don't need to know, you can always challenge the atheist or the skeptic and say, well, you know, you think this is a bad design. You know, I believe in the God of the Bible. My faith is that this will prove to be a good design. You know, since you're the scientist and I'm not, why don't we just simply put this to the test? Let the scientific community research this problem to a greater degree. And, you know, if I'm right about my Christian worldview, we're going to see the evidence of this so-called bad design being transformed into a good design. But if you're right, we're going to see accumulating evidence that it's a bad design. Admittedly, neither you nor I completely understand this whole situation. Let's just put this to the test and see which way it goes. And you can do that with any bad design that people bring up. And incidentally, one thing I can tell you about all these examples of bad design, the bad designs that the atheists are throwing up in our face are all in the arena where science is the most complex and the least understood. That should be a tip-off. Okay, where things are simple and well understood, we don't see bad designs being thrown up in our face. It's only in the places where we don't have the understanding. That's the point that the Lord makes here in Job. He's saying, okay, why are you questioning me in those areas where you lack so much understanding? That's exactly what's going on here. You get people questioning the Lord's design of the human eyeball, for example, when they admit in their own writings that they don't lack, that they lack complete understanding of the system. Well, if you want the answer, it's this. These light receptors need a tremendous amount of energy. And so you'd be amazed at how much blood flow, for example, simply supports our eyes and the nerves that take the information from the eye to the brain. So there's a need to get a lot of energy into those light receptors. And if you put them on the front end of the eyeball structure, then there's no efficient way to get blood to those receptors. But if you put them on the back, then it's real easy to get energy in there. It's also easy to take the heat away. Because whenever you're bringing in a lot of blood, there's a lot of heat. And the problem is you don't want those receptors to overheat. It's necessary to keep them. So you need an efficient way to get the blood away from those receptors as well. And then when you look at the human eye in more detail, you discover that the structure that supports the light receptors is extremely transparent to light, and is able to have light pass through where there's virtually no loss of definition. So in that sense, there's very little to be gained in terms of definition and transparency by putting the receptors on the front. You put them on the back, there's virtually no loss, and now you've got no problem with getting the energy that they need and taking away the heat that's necessary in order for these to function a long time. And what the scientists really failed to appreciate is that the human eye has been designed to function with high definition and high efficiency for 100 years. I mean, if you look at the design of putting them on the front instead of the back, yeah, the human eye might be able to function a little better if you can solve the energy problem, but it's not going to be a long-lasting system. And we all want to keep our eyes for more than a few weeks. So if you want to keep them for 100 years plus, then it really has to be designed the way it is. And that's just part of it. There's been a lot of other issues in the human eye, like the fact that you've got this upside-down image problem. They say that's a bad design. But hey, God has designed our brains to be able to handle an upside-down image and turn it right side up. And if you don't believe me, this star party that's being organized for the youth here in the church, one of the things I learned when I first got into astronomy is when you look through the eyepiece of a telescope, it gives you an upside-down image. But if you use a telescope for a while, your brain automatically turns it around. And so you don't even notice it's an upside-down image. You know, the brain has been amazingly designed to handle that. And so this design problem in the human eye really isn't a problem, because of the way God has designed the brain to take care of that problem. Okay, question. The main difference with the human eye, by the way, relative to other eyes, and this is something, again, that the people complaining about bad designs really haven't picked up on, is you look at the human eyes compared to the eyes of other birds and mammals, ours are different in that you've got this pupil and iris surrounded by a large white area. Okay? Maybe you've noticed that. Your dogs and cats and the birds in your home, the cows out in the field, they're not designed that way. You basically look at their eye and you kind of just see one amorphous color there. The human eye is different. I mean, as I look out at all of you, I can see the whites of your eyes. And by looking at the whites of your eyes, I can tell where you're looking. And the whole point here, and this has just been recently discovered by psychologists, well, not recently, 10 years ago, that because of the whites of the human eye, we have the capacity to communicate with one another with our eyes when there's thousands of us together in a group. I mean, you can do that. You can be in this kind of big, huge social function, and you can make eye contact with someone and know that they're looking back at you, and then you go over and talk to them, right? You can tell them they're interested in talking to you, whatever. But we're really the only species that needs that level of communication. The other species, they just want to know, oh yeah, there's something over there I can kill or something over there I can eat. And you really don't have that social communication. Where they are communicating socially, it's kind of like one-on-one or one-on-two. But we humans who are talking all the time and communicating all the time with thousands of people around us, it really is critical that we be able to use our eyes to single one another out. And again, I mean, you can see those married couples. They can look at one another from 50 feet away, and there's communication going on even though they're not saying anything. And it's because of the way our brain is structured and the way we have a communication system that's unique to all the other animals. Now the question is this: how did we get those whites of the eyes anyway? I mean, the evolutionists will say, well, that evolved from the apes. Okay, let's look at the apes. None of them have whites in their eyes. Okay, and well, maybe it was something that evolved as the human species. Well, the human species has only been here 50,000 years. How can you evolve, let's say, a gorilla eye into the present human eye in only 50,000 years? And then they've been able to recover soft tissue from humans who've been dead 20 and 30,000 years, and the whites of their eyes are just like ours. There's no difference. So, yep. Now, that's used in battle all the time. Or what I told my son when he was about 3 years old about, you know, I said, you know, because he was watching this movie where it says fire at will. I said, "What's that all about?" And I said, "Well, you know, they just don't like Will." Then when he was about 11 years old, he came back to me and says, "Dad, you tricked me." Took him 8 years to figure out that I tricked him. So now I realize, you know, you got to be careful what kind of jokes to tell your kids. Now they don't believe anything I tell them. So but no, that's another piece of advice that I give you about these so-called bad designs in nature. Look for an opportunity to turn the tables on them. Okay, for example, okay, we're talking about the eye and the inverted retina, and then you're kind of explaining what that's all about. Then you can raise another issue to, say, the skeptic. Have you ever thought where we got the whites of our eyes and what purpose they might serve? In other words, what we're doing is showing design features in the eye that they've never even considered. And if the eye has this kind of design feature in the whites of the eyes, then maybe there's something going on in this inverted retina that we don't fully appreciate. You're just kind of planting seeds. What I'm doing here is just kind of giving you clues. There's a problem I've run into with working with our volunteers is say, what if they bring up an issue that we simply haven't heard discussed before? I said, well, you don't always have to have the answer. You can go back and say, look, maybe I can look that up for you, or maybe we can make this a test. But there are things that we can do to kind of say, well, you know, isn't it interesting? This is something that's extremely complex that no scientist claims to have complete understanding over. Maybe there's something here we don't really see in the way of the design. So, and by the way, we are saying it reasons to believe that we should expect some evidence for bad designs in nature. Why? Because when God creates species of life, after he creates them, he leaves them alone. Psalm 104, we're going to eventually be talking about the creation psalms. You know, God creates life and he lets them exist under the laws of physics. Those laws of physics will cause them to degrade, to decay, and eventually go extinct, and then God recreates. In other words, the biblical pattern here is that when God creates life, he doesn't continue to intervene in that species, although he might. There's some evidence he may have done that for the human species that we talked about when we went through the flood account. But typically what he does is he creates the species and lets it exist under those natural conditions. And as it tells us in Romans 8, the entire creation is subject to the law of decay. So we would expect the great designs that God has placed into different species of life to gradually and slowly degrade over time. And to give you one example for the human species, is that we're now carrying a much heavier load of diabetics than we used to carry in the past. And, you know, is this God's design? No, I think it's a product of the fact that today we have better health care. And people would normally die from childhood diabetes, wind up growing old enough that they can marry and reproduce and have children with the same kind of problem. And so we've seen the number of people in our population per capita with diabetic problems increase. Now, mind you, there's also our diet and our lifestyle that's bringing about another kind of diabetes into the population, in which case you can say it's the decay of man's spirit that's responsible for this accumulating bad design in our species. So in that sense, we would expect that the longer a species has been on the face of the earth, the greater the accumulation of corruption in its ideal design. But this is no different than the argument about a car that's been designed by, say, Toyota Motors. If you expose it to salt in Toronto, I mean, in Toronto they put salt on the roads. And, you know, even very well-designed cars are a rust pile after 4 or 5 years. They just get exposed to the environment. But that really doesn't tell us that the Toyota Manufacturing Company makes bad cars. It's just that, yeah, they do make good cars, but they will decay as they are exposed. Or if you let your car be driven by certain members of the family, that can hasten decay as well. So I'm discovering I'm having to replace the brakes on our car more frequently. So, and this again is something that is brought up here in Job 40, is that you know, you're calling me into question, God says, but what about you and the way you understand things and the way you manage things? But I thought what was most interesting about our discussion in Job 40, in terms of where we fail to understand God's designs in nature, he makes the point in verse 11 and verse 12 that where we really lack understanding is in the pride of humanity. Who understands what makes us so proud before this great Creator? And yet we have this pride. And then God makes this challenge to Job and his friends. He says, look at every proud man and humble him. Crush the wicked where they stand. Bury them all in dust together. Shroud their faces in the grave. Then I myself will admit to you that your own right hand can save you. So he's basically saying, you guys think you're so smart, you think you're so powerful, let me give you a challenge. Go humble that proud man. Okay? We cannot do that. We don't understand the pride of man. And we have no capacity to bring a proud man to his humility. You know, this is something we need to emphasize in our ministry all the time. We are not the ones that bring the proud to humility. Only God can do that. We have no capacity there. That's what God is saying to the five men that are assembled there. He says, okay, look at the pride around you. I'm going to just step back and see what you can do. Okay, we can't do anything. Unless God's Holy Spirit moves within the heart of a man or a woman, there will be no submission to the authority of God. Who can understand the pride of man? Who can understand the wickedness of the human heart? We can't. We stand back and say, we have no understanding. And if we can't understand that, then why would we be so proudful to say, God doesn't know what he's doing, God is clumsy, God is not very powerful, and he really doesn't care for us at all, which is really what the heart of people is saying. There are these bad designs in nature. Now, by the way, I predict that, you know, this list I gave you about a dozen bad designs that are being promoted in the popular media as proof against the Christian faith, if you develop answers against those 12, they're going to come up with another 12. Okay? So, you know, they may come up with one as, you know, why do we humans have so much hair since hair gets in the way so much? So, or why don't we have hair enough to protect us from the sun? I mean, stuff like that. So they're just going to keep coming up with them. But as I mentioned last time, the panda's thumb, the human appendix, the human tailbone, the S-shape of the human backbone, why we men have nipples, the scrotal sac for humans, the inverted retina of the eye. And by the way, Rosick raised that question about these creatures that have eyes that are not synchronous. You know, that's quite interesting that we have in the biological record really two different kinds of creatures of two eyes. You've got creatures like us who have eyes that are binocular in the sense that we have separated eyes that can look at the same object, and by looking at the same object there's triangulation. Our brain can take into effect to determine the distance of the object. If you had only one eye, then I wouldn't be able to tell how far apart all of you were. But with two eyes, I can say, well, you're in the front row. You're only a few feet from me. You're in another few feet. And then on towards the back. We have this perception of depth. And one thing that's been brought up, by the way, by these skeptics is the question, well, you know, depth perception is great. Why didn't God put our eyes this far apart so we get a really good depth perception instead of this far apart? Well, I mean, the problem there is that you've got to have structure to support that. And also there's a problem if your eyes are too far apart, and it makes it difficult to focus on objects that are close. And so what scientists have discovered in the process is that the separation of the human eyes is really at the ideal distance. And likewise, we discover when you look at lions and tigers and horses, they have roughly the same separation we do. There's a good reason. There's an ideal distance for those eyes to be separated. But then there's these creatures that you brought up, like these lizards and amphibians, where they got, instead of two eyes in the front, they got an eye on the side here and an eye on the side there. And what's amazing about these eyes is that they can rotate independently of one another, look at things independently of one another. And so, I mean, you see these lizards where their eye is rotating like this and they're going all over the place, the other eye is standing still. And it's kind of strange to look at, but it's the ideal design for snatching bugs out of the midair that are flying at high speed. I mean, you know, the creatures that have those kinds of systems, whether they be fish, or they be frogs, or they be lizards. These are creatures that kind of just sit there, and you know, they're really not moving. They just find a good place where they know these kinds of fish or insects are going to be zipping by them at high speed. But one eye remains stationary, looking at the creature, then the other eye is rotating around, and what they're doing is trying to figure out the trajectory of the bug. And by figuring out the trajectory, they can figure out where it will be, and then this long tongue goes snapping out and pulls them in, right? You've seen that. Yeah. Right. But yeah, they're gauging things first, and then you get that long, then the tongue goes flying out. Right. Yeah. John. Right. And with human sin, you're going to get a more rapid degradation. So it's in the human population that you can find many more examples of a degraded design. So that's the whole point here. I'm trying to make a distinction between designs that were inherently bad and good designs that have been degraded through human abuse or simply by being exposed to the laws of physics. And the more complex the species, the more rapidly it will degrade. And so, for example, ants don't degrade at the same rate as, say, chimpanzees in terms of their design. They're a lot less complex than the chimpanzee. And so, you know, we see the con, and also the bigger you are, the more likely you are to degrade under the laws of physics. After all, the bigger you are, the more subject you are to degradation from gravity. I mean, a lot of us have experienced that, right? Our bodies are big enough where gravity does some significant degradation over time. Hey, either that clock is slow or it's a little slow because the bells rang a little bit early. But I think I'll close it off here. And you know, feel free to bring up bad designs in the future. If a new one comes up, we'll be happy to have our team research it and we can talk about it. But I just want you to be aware that this is an issue you can expect to be thrown up in front of you by skeptics, because evidently it's kind of a new strategy. By the way, the old strategy was to say, well, there's evil in the world, therefore there can't be a God, because God wouldn't tolerate evil. This is kind of similar to that. A good God, a smart God, a powerful God, wouldn't create with bad designs. But again, we need to have the humility to realize, okay, we're charging God with bad designs in those very arenas where we don't have very good understanding. Who are we? And that's kind of the message here of Job 40. Let's close. Father in heaven, we want to thank you for being born at such an exciting time in human history. The beginning of the 21st century really is astounding at how it's giving us new reasons to believe in you. And Lord, I'm just so grateful that I'm in a discipline where new evidences for supernatural design are so rapidly forthcoming. And we thank you too, Lord, that we are getting these kinds of challenges from skeptics and atheists. And Father, I pray that you would grant us the grace and the humility to wisely deal with these challenges and deal with them in such a way that rather than causing offense to the people we speak, we would arouse their curiosity, get them thinking, get them asking questions, and encouraging them to submit to your Spirit's call upon their life, to release their pride and to humble themselves before you. Father, I pray that as believers in Jesus Christ, we would recognize your call upon us to a life of humility. And so, Father, help us in our day-to-day walk and our talking with you in our prayers to recognize where we need to take those steps and submit ourselves before you. Lord, give us a greater appreciation for what you've done in this universe and done in our lives. Cause us to be grateful. Cause us to be thankful as we enter into this Thanksgiving season. In Jesus' name, amen.